Okay. So we have an introduction to wrap up, and then, as I said in the email, I would like to make some headway in Perek Aleph in chapter 1. So last time we gave a basic introduction to the book. We talked about the eternal nature of his message, the importance of the book in our liturgy, in our language. We talked a little bit about some of the controversy related to certain passages in Yeshaya, specifically regarding the use by Christianity of some of the passages. We gave a little bit of a background on the timeline in terms of when this took place, who the kings were, the kings of Judea with whom Yeshaya dealt directly, as well as a little bit about the kings of Yisrael and the nations around us. And then we gave some background on the book itself as a book of consolation, as it's identified in the Talmud, despite the fact that there are passages that are decidedly not consoling, not comforting.
Chapter 1.
Yes, that would be an example. We talked a little bit about the storyline of the book, showing how you only have two passages in it that are story-oriented in the way we usually think about a narrative. And we sort of gave a little bit of an outline in that sense. Then we talked about the themes of the book, defining righteousness, talking about our relationship with God, and Yeshaya's vision for the future, for a messianic time. We dealt a little bit with the authorship. That's something we're going to have to come back to. But that brings us to the last portion of our introduction, which is Yeshaya the man himself. Who was he? What do we know about him? The name Yeshaya itself means what?
God will save.
God will save. Why will?
God save.
Yeshua, right, is salvation, right? That's true. But there's no future tense to it. It's not Yoshia, for example, which would have that kind of connotation. The Dat Mikra thinks that it may be read as Hashem is Yish'i. God is my Yeshua, the source of my salvation. That could be. It's always rendered as Yeshayahu, interestingly, in Tanakh. The name Yeshaya does show up in Tanakh, but not for him. He is always named Yeshayahu. Nonetheless, people, myself included, tend to say Yeshaya just because we're lazy. It's easier than adding the syllable at the end. It means the same thing for all intents and purposes. He comes from a family which seems to be royal, or at least powerful. You see that in the fact that he's very comfortable dealing with kings. He's going to speak his mind to multiple kings, including some very powerful and dangerous people. And we noted last time the Gemara, which I brought you here in source number 1, which says, Davar zeh masores biyadeinu me'avoseinu. The Talmud says, we have a tradition, Amos ve'amatzia achim havu, that Amos and Amatzia were brothers. Which seems like a little bit of an odd thing for parents to do, on the whole, right? To name your kid Amot, and then name your other kid Amatzia. Seems a little bit strange, but not without precedent, or successor, I guess, because I don't know who did it before them. But it's not so strange to think that one would do it. What it really means for our purposes is that Amos, we know, is Yeshaya's father. And Amatzia, we mentioned last time, was a king. So what it would mean is that Yeshaya is a relative of all of these kings whom he is rebuking. That's not unusual. If you think of Yirmiyahu, who rebukes the Kohanim of Anatot, those are his family. So it's not strange to see a prophet rebuke his relatives. Another example of that would be Ovadia, who, according to tradition, is himself a descendant of Edom, and his prophecy is a rebuke for Edom. So we have that with others. He could very well be a descendant of that kind of authority. The only problem with that midrash... there are two problems with that midrash. Number one is that it makes him awfully old, because that would mean he is the first cousin of King Uzziahu, who we talked about last time. Uzziahu was the first king to whom he prophesied, but Uzziahu dies at the age of 68. So, assuming that first cousins are more or less the same generation, and recognizing that there could be some variation, but let's put him at roughly the same time. I mean, Uzziah was 68 when he dies. After that, you have Yotam for 16 years. We noted last time there may be some overlap between Yotam and Uzziah. Then Ahaz for another 16 years, and Chizkiyahu for another 39 years. That's an awful lot of years. It means that you'd be talking about him being an active prophet until somewhere on the age of 140. Which, you know, again, first cousins do not have to be the same age precisely. It's possible there's a gap of 20 years. So it's only until he's 120. My point, I think, is fairly clear here, which is even if you can play with the years somewhat, putting his father as the brother of Amaziah is challenging. Not to mention, he also produces children in the time of King Ahaz, which we're going to see. So, you know, King Ahaz being king some 20 years after Uzziah was dead, that makes Yeshaya somewhere of the same generation as somebody who would have been 88 years old. Yeah.
Remember that Saul Bellow had a child, I think, at 82.
Okay, so Saul Bellow could do it. And he was an author. So, yeah. Sorry.
No, we're talking about...
Okay. So, it's doable. The question is, in the Gemara itself, they don't bring you any biblical passages. It doesn't say, here's a text and we deduce from this text. It just says we have a tradition. So I look at it more in terms of what is it trying to teach me, and I think it is trying to teach me that Yeshaya comes from royalty and he rebukes royalty. He's not someone who doesn't know what he's talking about. He's not someone who just hates kings and is jealous of their wealth and their power, and so he is going to tear into them. He's from that world. And I think that's a key point that the Gemara wants us to learn here, is that Yeshaya is someone who speaks with knowledge when he talks about the sins of the kings. That's number one. Number two, though, Ibn Ezra says it's a practical lesson to be learned from that idea. Take a look at source number three, please. Talking about Yeshaya's pedigree, he says, "V'yesh b'divrei yachid." There is a lone view. Source number two. I said three. Okay, let's put a difference. Source two and a half. "V'yesh b'divrei yachid, ki kol navi shenis karshem aviv gam hu navi." He says, first of all, there is a lone view that says that when a prophet's father is named, that means that he, the father, was also a Navi. We're going to come back to that idea. But he says, there is such a tradition. And some say that he is from royal descent. That Amotz, his father, and Amaziah, the king, were brothers. Which is why they couldn't do to him what they did to Yirmiyahu. In other words, this is another reason why I would conclude that he is of royal blood. Not only that he's not afraid of them, but also that they aren't able to dispose of him. Yirmiyahu gets thrown in a pit, put into the stockade, they try to kill him. Yeshaya, in contrast, is never really abused or harmed. So this would explain why. The answer is he's part of the royal family. Now, the truth is that if you look at the Northern Kingdom, you find people in the royal family killing each other to take over the throne. So I'm not so sure that this really insulates you entirely from harm in the Middle East. Nonetheless, Ibn Ezra says, maybe that's how he escapes trouble. He then goes on to discuss the issue of Yeshaya's father, and he says, Valdera Hapshat, on a simple level, going back to the idea that if you mention a prophet, son of a prophet, that means his father was one as well. So he says, on a simple level, Ki kol navishin izkar shem aviv hu gadol v'noda sodo b'doro. On a simple level, if it mentions the prophet and the prophet's father, that means that he is important. Literally translated, his secret is known in his generation, meaning everybody knows who he is. V'yesh me'em shu navi, v'yesh ena navi. Sometimes he is a prophet, sometimes he's not. But the point is, you document a name because it's supposed to mean something to your audience. When you say, Yeshaya, son of Amotz, the name Amotz is meaningful to the crowd, or you wouldn't have bothered to say it. I don't care if he's the son of Amotz, if I don't know what an Amotz is. So that tells me that his father must be somebody with some standing. And then he adds one more source to suggest that Yeshaya's father is, in fact, a Navi, a Pasuk in Divrei Hayamim Bet. The Pasuk says, Bachazon Yeshayahu ben Amoz Hanavi. In the prophecy of Yeshayahu, son of Amoz, the prophet. So the question is simply, right, what's your antecedent? What is prophet referring to there? The prophet, is that back to Yeshaya, or is that on Amoz? And if it has to acknowledge, could read it either way. So it could be his father is a prophet. He certainly, though, is somebody of standing. One other note to support the idea that his father is a king, and I think I mentioned this briefly last week, is the Maharsha and the Gemara in Chagiga. The Gemara in Chagiga was what I mentioned last week, actually. The Gemara says that both Chizkiyahu and Yeshaya see Hashem's throne room, but that they describe it differently. Not Chizkiyahu, Yechezkel, sorry. Both Yechezkel and Yeshaya see Hashem's throne room, but they describe it differently. Yechezkel is very impressed with all the grandeur, whereas Yeshaya focuses on what the angels are saying. And our answer was, Yeshaya is more familiar with grandeur. He is a dweller of Yerushalayim. He is familiar with the monarchy, which was based in Yerushalayim. As Yechezkel, he is rural, number one, and then number two, he's part of the Galus Babel, he's part of the exile in Babylon. He didn't really see that kind of power. So the Maharsha, commenting in source number 13, adds to that idea that Yechezkel is the villager, whereas Yeshai is the one who's familiar with the monarchy. He says, in source number 3, Yechezkel Domes, sorry, number 3. It is number 3. Yechezkel Domela Ben Kfar. Yechezkel was like a villager. I imperish Rashi v'Tosfos. He says, see Rashi and Tosfos and why we compare him to a villager. V'od Nira Lefaresh. You could also explain this. Al Shem Mashakasu Perak Haroah. Based on the Gemara in Brachos. The Gemara in Brachos is talking about a completely different issue, which is saying a blessing when you see a king. The Gemara there talks about saying a blessing when you see royalty. And the Gemara there says, Malchusa de'ara kei Malchusa de'rakia. Looking at human royalty reflects royalty above, meaning it gives a person appreciation for the grandeur of God when you see the grandeur of a human king. The regalia, the pomp and ceremony and all of that, it gives you an appreciation for what it means that there should be something that is above. Malchusa Dirikia, the monarchy in heaven.
Not a very good comparison.
Well, it depends on your era, doesn't it? I think so. I'm gonna stop there lest I get myself into trouble. The Ulufisha Haya Yeshaya ben Krach ben Isgadel b'Yerushalayim ben Melachim. So he says Yeshaya is urban and he grows up in Yerushalayim among kings. Kidde Amrina, and he quotes our Gemara, Da Amoz v'Amatzia Achim Havu, that his father Amoz was the brother of King Amatzia. And therefore have a Ragil b'Malchusa de'ara. He was familiar with the human monarchy, and therefore Lohaya Masmiya Nami Kolkaf the Machusa Derekia, he wasn't as stunned by what he saw in his vision, as opposed to Yechezkel. Yechezkel's a villager. He's part of that same family that Yirmiyahu was part of, the Kohanim in the city of Anatot, he says. And therefore he wasn't as familiar with monarchy. Okay. Either way, what we're getting an image of here is somebody who is familiar with the corridors of power. And his father may be the brother of the king. His father may be a prophet. He's certainly important enough that the book takes the time to name him and expect that the reader is going to know that this is somebody of significance. Yeshaya starts his career relatively young, in the sense that, as I mentioned, he's having children in the time of King Ahaz, which, it's true, could be older. We generally assume that means that somebody is younger. And we already noted last time his death at the hands of King Menasha, according to the Gemara. We know very little about his wife. We're never given a name for her, we think. However, we might know her name. And the reason I say that that's not her, that's his daughter. I'm going to get to his daughter. I was confusing two things. We don't know his wife's name. We do know that they have a son together named Sha'ar Yashuv. He'll be featured in the 7th chapter. In the 7th chapter, we will also find out that there is an Alma, Ayin Lamed Mem Hei, who he predicts will produce a child whose name will be Emmanuel. However, it's not clear that this Alma is his wife, as we'll see when we get to Perek Zayin. It may be referring to something entirely different. And of course, the most famous issue there is the question of whether Alma means virgin. The answer is it does not, but we'll see it when we get there. Yes.
You say they don't mention his wife's name. Do they in Yecheskel, Is it common to mention a wife?
Right, so it's not common to mention a wife if she doesn't feature in a story, but here she does play into the story. We're going to mention her. She's even going to be identified at one point as Hanevi'ah, which could mean she's a prophet, or it could mean wife of the prophet. You could read that either way. Right, it could be like Revitin. We're going to see that in chapter 8. When she has a son, Maher Shalal Chashbaz. But we'll get to that when we get to that. But the answer is that it's unusual to mention them if they don't have a role. However, I should add, in Melachim, we mention the wives of many of the kings and the mothers of many of the kings, even though they don't seem to have a role in the story. We're just told, and his mother was, and his wife was. Yes, Melachim Bet is the place you want to read. If you want to get a quick introduction to the names of the kings and their generations and who's listed as good and who's listed as bad, your best bet is to look at Kings 2, chapters 14 to 21, basically. And you'll be bored. And then so-and-so became the king in Judea at the same time as so-and-so was the king in Yisrael. And then we'll go through a few things about him, generally not too much. And then we'll get, and so-and-so became the king in Yisrael when so-and-so was the king in Judea. And we go back and forth between them. Some of the kings get more discussion, Chizkiyahu, Yoshiyahu, and a lot of them don't.
Yeah. Is
Dvorah
referred to as a
Nevi'ah? Yes. Dvorah, Isha,
Nevi'ah. So why do we think that Nevi'ah is an honorific guy?
Only because we don't have any reference to any story with her or any Nevu'ah that she gave. With Dvorah, we get this whole story about her saying her Nevu'ah, which is it's time to go to war. And you have her song afterwards. Here we don't know anything. That's, I think, what leads to some of the doubt. By the way, now that I think people have made it in general, I just want to make sure to mention, you saw the gate was down in the parking lot. Don't panic. We have the code for people to be able to get out. The code is to be used for this class specifically. I don't think the code will work at other times. I gave you them in the back table, but I can read it out at the end of the class also. So you're not going to be charged for parking here during the class.
And if you want to, for $5, you get a fob, or it gets you $25, which is a deposit, and you get a fob that just lets you in and out and in and out. When you return it, you'll get your money back.
Okay, so that's in terms of his wife, and again, he's going to have a couple of kids, at least a couple, and he has a daughter. The text doesn't make any issue of this. The way we know about the daughter is a Gemara in Brachos in source number 4, which we're going to have to spend some time on much later on when we get, God willing, to the story of King Chizkiyahu. But I brought you only a small excerpt of the story. Chizkiyahu is ill. It is the illness that leads him to think he's going to die. And Yeshaya comes to him and says he's going to die. And as the Gemara tells the story, and we'll have to see how this fits into the passage itself, but as the Gemara tells the story, Yeshaya says, well, what have I done wrong? And he says back to him, you didn't have any children. And Chizkiyahu says, well, I didn't have any children because I was warned that my child was going to be a terrible king and lead people astray. And Yeshaya's response is, that's not your business. You have a command. Your command is to try to have children. Some people will succeed, some people will not succeed, but that's your job, is not to try to read God's mind. That's the rebuke that Yeshaya gives him. So Chizkiyahu's response to him is what you see in number 4. Amar Lei, Chizkiyahu says to Yeshaya, Hashta havli batach. Well, if you really think I'm supposed to have a child, then give me your daughter in marriage. Maybe between your merit and my merit, he doesn't say anything about the daughter's merit, they'll be able to have good children. We don't know anything about her in this story. It's not the Gemara's point. The Gemara is trying to teach various lessons in this story, and frankly, she's just in the story as a way to carry those lessons through. Amar Lei, Yeshaya says, "Kvar nigzor alecha gzeira." It's too late. God already issued his decree. You're done. Amar Lehi, he says back to him, Ben Amots, son of Amots. And very often in the Gemara, when somebody is referred to as son of their father, it's an insult. You don't have standing. You don't have any significance. In the same way that often the Malachim, when they are harsh to Moshe, say Ben Amram. It's the same idea. So he says, Ben Amots, Kalein Vos Havitzei, finish your prophecy and get out. Kach mekublani mi beis avi abba. This is my tradition from my grandfather's house, meaning David HaMelech. Afilu cherev chada munachas al tzavar shel adam al yimna atzmo min ha'achamim. Even if there is a sharp sword on a person's neck, he should never refrain from davening for mercy. He says he should always daven. It doesn't matter what things look like. That's his statement. And then he marries Yeshaya's daughter, and they have a son whose name is Menashe, who proceeds to lead the Jews astray for the first 22 years of his monarchy, a story we alluded to a little bit last time. After that, he tries to do tshuva, as we're taught in Tanakh. But the point that I bring this for is only the fact that Chizkiyahu's wife's name is known to us. Chizkiyahu's wife is a woman by the name of Hefziba. Hefziba. Like a chepetz. Chepetz is desire. The Hefziba. My desire is in her. She is beloved. That's Hefziba. The other place we use the term Hefziba is for... What else is called Hefziba? What slash who? Ooh, boy. Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim is Chetziba. Yes. Yeah. So yes. Sorry, the significance of it is the city of Hashem's desire. Yeah. That's the idea. So when you see somebody named Hephzibah, that's what they're named for. Yes.
I apologize if this has been gone over before. Does anyone correlate this royalty concept to Moshe?
Right? What do you mean? Moshe being raised by the king, you mean?
Living, learning leadership in the king's.
Interesting. I haven't seen anybody note that in particular. It's an interesting point. Maybe it's worth tracking in general in Yeshaya to see, are there other associations between Yeshaya and Moshe? That will be an interesting question. They do?
Yeah.
Okay. So Debbie is going to be responsible along the way to point out the Yeshaya Moshe connections. You bet. You said it.
No. I read it. I didn't say it.
Okay. Yeshaya also has Talmidim. Yeshaya has students. They're referred to at various times within the book. They may be what we call B'nai Nevi'im, which means not sons of prophets, but student prophets. It may even be the group that we mentioned last week who are involved in writing the book down with Chizkiyahu. They are charged with carrying the message forward. So, for example, if you take a very fast look at Yeshaya chapter 30, sentence 8, just to give you an example, it is in the Stone of Tanakh, page 1003, the very bottom.
What's the chapter?
Chapter 30, sentence 8. Atav bo kasva aluach itam ve'al sefer chuka ushil yom acharon la'ad ad olam. He is told, Yeshaya is told, to write down this message on a tablet with them, with the students, and it should be inscribed on a book, and they'll keep it until Yom Acharon, some day in the future. It should endure forever. So he gave them messages that were not necessarily for his day. They may have been relevant for some future time. I mentioned it last week when we talked about Yeshaya presenting prophecies that would have been meaningless for people in his day, like the future King Cyrus, the Persian. They don't know anything about at this point. It could be that's one of these messages that is given to the students for them to record and keep with them until such time as it's going to be relevant. That just wraps up a little bit about him as a person. We're going to learn a lot more about him, obviously, as we see his stories and as we see his messages. Questions or thoughts about that before we move into the book itself? Yes, Mush.
Just very quickly, when you talk about how long this lifespan as a Navi, is it possible that this school of Yeshaya that you just mentioned, that would explain the latter years when they were being following and perhaps expressing by others based on his teachings.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I would think so. Okay. Other thoughts or questions on the introduction before we hit the... yes, Dahlia.
Well, I was just going to say, in line with what you said at the very first class, that there may have been more than one author. There are...
I said it's alleged. I happen to not buy into it, but yes, there is a school of thought that says that there's more than one Yeshaya.
Right. That would tie into the idea of the longevity.
Right, so it actually wouldn't necessarily help. The reason I say that is because the longevity problem is that he names four kings that he addresses, and they're all addressed by the person who, those who believe there are multiples, identify as Isaiah 1. They make their split at chapter 40, which is after Chizkiyahu already. Their split is based much more on the content of it, saying that the tone of the book is different after that point, but it wouldn't solve the longevity problem. I'm sure Sansino has a lot to say about it. I'm sure I disagree with about half of what he says. But we'll get to it when we get to chapter 40, God willing, a year from now. We're going to have to talk more substantively about the reasons for and against, what this is about, where it comes from, and God willing, we will do so. Okay.